This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Where do the candidates stand on our energy future, on drilling for oil, and on creating new sources of cleaner, more sustainable sources of energy? My guest is New York Times columnist Tom Friedman. He's written a new book called Hot, Flat, and Crowded: Why We Need a Green Revolution and How It Can Renew America. Hot refers to global warming. Flat, to the global economy that has put the American middle class in competition with workers around the world. Crowded refers to rapid population growth. Friedman says hot, flat, and crowded have converged to tighten energy supplies, expand the extinction of plants and animals, deepen energy poverty, strengthen petro-dictatorships, and accelerate climate change. Friedman has won 3 Pulitzer Prizes for his work with the New York Times. His best-selling books include From Beirut to Jerusalem and The World is Flat. Tom Friedman, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, I was reading your book last Wednesday night while I was listening to the Republican convention. So as I was reading your thoughts on ending our oil addiction, I heard Rudy Giuliani lead a chant of drill, baby, drill. And as I listened to everybody chanting drill, baby, drill at the Republican convention, I was wondering, what will Tom Friedman have to say about that? So what do you have to say about that?
Well, I started to imagine a column where the Saudi, Russian, and Venezuelan observers at the Republican convention were watching this. And what would they be saying to each other? They would be up there in one of those skyboxes, high-fiving each other. It is happy days are here again. Drill, baby, drill. Because what basically Giuliani was leading that crowd into saying is, let's stay addicted to oil. And boy, that is the best news in the world for the Venezuelan, Russian, and Saudi delegates. They couldn't have scripted a chant like that better themselves.
Why?
Because basically, what is it that they want? They're looking for the United States to remain focused on fossil fuels and not throw everything, and I mean everything, Terry, into innovation around clean energy technologies and a clean energy system. You know, when I think about that drill, baby, drill mantra, Terry, you know what I'm reminded of? It's as if that Republican convention on the eve of the birth of the internet and the personal computer was up chanting, let's stick with IBM Selectric typewriters. IBM Selectrics forever. Type, type, type. Okay? We're on the eve of a new technological revolution. It's as if on the eve of the PC and the internet, the entire convention was standing up and chanting for IBM Selectric typewriters. What a wonderful bridge to the 20th century.
Well, I'd love to hear your brief takes on where the candidates stand on energy. So let's start with John McCain.
Well, you know, I'm very disappointed in John McCain, I have to tell you, Terry, because he's someone I respect as a leader, as a political figure, and someone who, as I thought about this campaign before it began, I thought, wow, this is great. For the first time, we're going to have 2 green candidates. And I don't think that anymore. There has been a bill pending before the U.S. Senate for the last year. It's been voted on or attempted to pass 8 times. This gets a little technical, but it's very important. It's a bill to extend the production and investment tax credits for wind and solar energy. So if Terry Gross wants to start a company to put solar panels up, you would get this tax credit that would make it enormously beneficial for you to do that. Or if Terry Gross wanted to start a wind company, you'd get this production credit. What's happening is on December 31st, the existing tax credits are going to expire. And for the last year, the U.S. Senate has been trying to pass an extension of these tax credits. And it has failed now 8 times. And all 8 times that bill was voted on, John McCain failed to show up, including one time when he was actually in Washington, D.C., and wouldn't come to vote, and it failed by one vote, 59-40. And that is very disappointing to me, especially since the biggest concentrated solar project in the world right now is on paper, ready to go, outside of where, Terry? Phoenix, Arizona. It involves something between 1,500 and 2,000 jobs, as much steel. These are big manufacturing blue-collar projects as the Golden Gate Bridge. And yet John McCain did not show up one time. Obama showed up 3 times and voted in favor. McCain did not show up once. That's one disappointment I have. Second disappointment is he supported a lifting of the federal gasoline tax for the summer driving season, which is such a absurd, ridiculous giveaway of federal tax dollars to encourage the worst kind of behavior, summer driving, which would only drive up demand for oil and make us more addicted. And lastly, he has been out, I'm really sorry to say, really misleading the American people, making them stupid by telling them that if we just drill today, your gasoline price at the pump will come down today. And therefore, if Obama doesn't say drill too, he is for raising your gasoline price at the pump today. It is bloody dishonest. It is making people stupid. And frankly, I find it disgusting at this critical moment.
Well, you have strong feelings. What about Barack Obama? What are you hearing from him about energy?
What I feel comes from Obama is all the right words are there. I read his website, his energy platform. When he speaks, he does speak in these terms of a transformative energy revolution and having it be the foundation of a new American industry and more jobs. But I don't feel like it's the core of what he's about. I don't feel it's really central. I feel like it's a box he's checked, you know, along with healthcare and immigration. So, you know, I give him, high marks for, I think, understanding the importance of the issue. But I don't give him very high marks for real passion or talking really honestly about what we're really going to need to do if we're going to lead this revolution.
Let me quote something that you've written. You've said, it's more important to change your leaders than your light bulbs. What do you mean by that?
What we need, Terry, to solve this problem is like in the IT revolution. We need 100,000 innovators in 100,000 garages trying 100,000 things, 100 of which will be really promising, 10 will be workable, and 3 will be the next Google. How do you trigger that? Well, the only way you trigger that, in my view, is if you have a market. And we have a market, but that market's got to be shaped with the right price signals and the right standards, right rules and regulations. And basically, my argument is that it's leaders who write the rules. They're the ones who pass the tax law, the carbon tax, the gasoline tax, raise it or lower it. They're the ones who write the rules for energy standards and efficiencies. And only if you get the rules right in the market so it produces fuels from heaven – that is, clean fuels, not fuels from hell, dirty fuels, you're really not going to have this explosion of innovation that we need.
So you're not discouraging us from using energy-efficient light bulbs and appliances, but with everything we can do as individuals, it's not enough. You're saying we need a leadership that will have the right energy policies to create a green energy future. So,
exactly.
So you really stress taxes and incentives, taxes on oil and incentives for alternative energy. And why is that such a centerpiece of what you think is really essential to the future?
Well, it goes back to one of the central arguments here, which is that this is a huge scale problem. This is the biggest industrial project to try to move from a dirty fuel system. And that's what we have now. We have a dirty fuel system based on coal, oil, and natural gas. And Terry, it's a system, and it works really well. 6 blocks from your studio, there's a gasoline station that will fill up your car for $3 a gallon or $4 a gallon, whatever it is today, okay? And that system works really well. If we want to replace that. That is a huge scale project. And if you don't shape the market, all right, to give you the kind of innovation at scale that we need, you've really just got a hobby. I like hobbies. I used to build model airplanes. I play golf. I don't believe in trying to work with others to save the world as a hobby.
But, you know, with taxes on gasoline, that puts an extra burden on people who are struggling to get by. It makes it difficult just to get to work. So does a tax on gas unfairly burden the working class?
Absolutely, and which is why I believe it should be revenue neutral. And that is that we should tax what we don't want, which is people consuming fossil fuels. We should raise taxes on that, and we should lower taxes on what we do want, which is people working, which is why whatever tax increase we impose on oil, coal, or natural gas, we should take off on the other side from people's weekly payroll deduction. To me, it should be revenue neutral, or if not revenue neutral, you know, revenue neutral for all but the wealthiest Americans.
Now, you offer Denmark as a country that you visited that you think got it right a while ago. What did they do that's right?
Well, basically, you know, after the 1973 war and the first Arab oil shock, let's look at what America did and what Denmark did. You know, what we did was say, wow, we've got to really take on this issue. So, you know, beginning with President Ford and President Carter, we said we're going to double the fuel efficiency of American cars from it was about 13 miles per gallon then to I believe it was 27.5. And we're going to do that over 10 years. And we did that. And we were so successful in doing that, Terry, that we helped break OPEC in the late 80s and early 90s and really crater the price of oil. Well, that worked out so well that Ronald Reagan, when he came along, said, well, that's enough of that. And he ripped off the solar panels that Jimmy Carter put on the White House roof. They were recently auctioned online from a government warehouse. And he put a stop to all that regulatory efficiency. And we just kind of stopped. In fact, we have not raised our fuel efficiency standards. We didn't raise them for basically 30-odd years until just last year. Now, Denmark, by contrast, they fortunately discovered some oil and gas in the North Sea, but that wasn't the key. They basically put a huge tax on gasoline. For a while, they said people couldn't even drive on Sunday. They imposed a CO2 tax. Actually, if you go to your electric bill in Denmark, you can actually see a CO2 tax down there. And they invested in huge amounts of energy efficiency, new systems to basically capture the heat from burning coal and from incinerating waste products and use it for home heating. They did a whole series of efficiency steps and taxes and incentives, the net result of which was what? Their economy must have been crushed, right, Terry? Unemployment in Denmark today? 1.6%. Oh, but their companies must have absolutely been hammered. The leading wind company in the world today, Vestas, one out of every three wind turbines in the world today produced by Denmark. Novozymes and Danesco, the two leading ethanol enzymatic companies in the world, out of Denmark. In other words, what these rules, prices, and taxes did was shape the market in Denmark that stimulated all this innovation around energy efficiency, which produced new Danish companies to do this, which then went global, and they actually ended up buying the American wind companies that went bust in the 80s when Reagan basically took the subsidies away from wind and the U.S. Congress, Democrats included. Well, they were bought by Denmark, and today they're major Denmark companies. By the way, some of those solar companies that we spawned in the 70s and 80s, they went bust also when we removed our subsidies and taxes. They are bought by Japan. So I can't tell you how grateful the innovators and the corporate leaders of Japan and Denmark today are for all the money America invested in the research in wind and solar, which spawned companies here, which went bust in the 80s when we removed the subsidies for them, and they are bought by Japan and Denmark. Thank you very much. One of the leading wind innovators in America, in fact, was given a Medal of Honor by the government of Denmark, because basically all his technology ended up there. Have a nice day.
You know, you write a lot about the problems we're creating by not innovating our energy system and by relying on oil. And you write about how our oil addiction is supporting petro-dictatorships, funding terrorists, and supporting the most intolerant, anti-modern, anti-Western, anti-women's rights, anti-pluralistic strain of Islam, the strain propagated by Saudi Arabia. This is what you say in your book. And you add that our oil addiction is helping to finance a reversal of the democratic trends in Russia and Latin America that was set in motion by the fall of communism. How is our oil addiction helping to reverse democratic trends in Russia and Latin America?
Well, you know, just really look at Russia and Europe since 1989, Terry. We thought that the fall of the Berlin Wall was going to really herald and usher in an irreversible era of sort of democracy and peace in Europe. And for the first 15 years, it really did that. But those 15 years really coincided with oil in the $20 to $40 to even $50 a barrel range. But as we exploded out of that range into the $80, $90, $100, and all the way up to $140 barrel oil, it basically has galvanized, enriched, and empowered a whole group of petro-dictatorships that are now forming a counter-tide, a petro-dictatorship tide to the free market democracy tide unleashed by the fall of the Berlin Wall. And you can see that in Putin's Russia today. I coined in the book what I call the first law of petropolitics, which argues that the price of oil and the pace of freedom operate in an inverse correlation. And what I did was simply graph the price of oil from the late 1970s until 2005. And if you do that, it basically looks, you know, in rough numbers like $80, then fell in the 90s down to as low as $10, and then back up to $80 in the early 2000s. And so it looks like a V if you do that. Well, if you then – what I did was I went to Freedom House and got the Freedom House indexes for Russia, Venezuela, Iran, and Nigeria. And I just overlaid, you know, the Freedom House indexes, which are indexes of parliaments open, free and fair elections, women's groups begun, NGOs, et cetera. And if I overlaid it on top of that, what it looks is just like the opposite. And so what you see is that the price of oil and the pace of freedom actually operate in an inverse correlation.
Now, when you talk about Russia, you also, you know, point out that a lot of people credit Ronald Reagan with the fall of the Soviet Union. But you say the fall of the Soviet Union had to do with the price of oil.
I believe that was – and I mean it wasn't me saying, I'm really quoting Russian economists, Vladimir Mao and Igor Gaidar as really making that point. You know, I gave a talk in Moscow a couple of years ago at the U.S. Embassy about this issue, and in the talk I said that it was – you know, with all due respect to Ronald Reagan, it was $10 barrel oil that brought down the Soviet Union, which, after all, was the world's biggest oil producer. And after the talk, a Russian economist in the audience, Vladimir Mao, I was talking to him and I said, Vladimir, I'm right. It was $10 barrel oil that brought down the Soviet Union. He said, no, Tom, you're wrong. It was $80 barrel oil followed by $10 barrel oil that brought down the Soviet Union. And what he meant was what $80 barrel oil did in the 70s was really sucker the Soviet state into thinking it was stronger than it was. It extended itself into all kinds of areas, subsidies, imports, and whatnot. And then when $10 barrel oil came and they had to withdraw from all those areas, the whole system collapsed. By the way, Iran is ripe for the exact same phenomena.
Oh, how so?
A couple of years ago, Iran exported $44 billion worth of oil, and that was probably 80 or 90% of all Iranian exports or foreign currency earnings. The rest were probably carpets and pistachios. And in the same year, Iran's government spent $25 billion on subsidies. Subsidies of fuel, gasoline in Tehran at the time was like 30 cents a gallon. Subsidies of housing, education, all kinds of building, subsidies of food, etc. Now imagine if the price of oil were cut in half and suddenly Iran's total amount of subsidies was the same amount as the entire government budget. Well, what would that – there's a term for that in economics. It's called unsustainable. So Iran, which has about 12% unemployment today at $110 barrel oil, imagine what happens to that regime, which basically is just using this oil money to buy off its people. Imagine if that regime suddenly has to deal with $40 or $50 a barrel oil. Imagine what it does to Hezbollah. You know, Hezbollah launched a war against Israel a couple of years ago with an attack across the border. And then Israel came in, bombed all these Shiite neighborhoods in Beirut, smashed up the place. And suddenly, the morning after the war, Hezbollah, an Iranian-backed militia, was out there telling its people, you know, no problem, we'll rebuild your homes. You know, they reminded me of a group of kind of rich college students who rent a house on the beach, you know, for a weekend and smash up the place completely and then tell the landlord, flip him the keys and say, no problem, Dad will pay. Well, Iran was Dad. And Dad had tons of our oil money. And so Hezbollah could launch a war, get their housing areas in South Beirut, completely ravaged, and then say to people, no problem, Dad will pay.
So in that respect, you think our oil addiction is indirectly funding terrorism?
Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely doing so. It's funding just about every bad trend in the world today. I mean, if we could find a way to truly get off our addiction to oil, As Michael Mandelbaum says in the book, it isn't just win-win, Terry. It's win-win-win-win-win-win-win. Think of the things that happen. Our trade deficit dramatically improves. Our dollar strengthens. We weaken the worst regimes in the world. We mitigate global warming. We clean up our air. We become healthier, more secure, more economically strong, competitive, and respected in the world. And people are out there saying, drill, baby, drill? What planet are these people inhabiting? What am I missing here? What planet are you on exactly?
Well, if we are addicted to oil, who do you see as the real enablers in that addiction? Why aren't we changing?
Well, I mean, the oil companies are enablers, number one. They are huge campaign contributors to all parties, frankly. But they've certainly been longtime and deep contributors to the Republican Party. And they have no interest. Terry, let me ask you something. Doesn't it strike you as odd that here we have this bill before the Senate, okay, for extending – it's just a simple thing – extending the renewable and energy tax credits for wind and solar. And by the way, it's just for solar, it was for 8 years. For wind, it was 1 year. And by the way, in the solar and wind industries, they are completely frozen now, okay, because these tax credits haven't been extended. So people are finishing projects that will be covered by this year's tax credits, and virtually nobody starting new projects, unless you're T. Boone Pickens and have $4 billion, into the future. You couldn't make that up, okay? That at this key time in America, all right, we are basically grinding down our wind and solar energy industries. Now, we had a president named George Bush went out and told us we're addicted to oil. So do you think that president might lift a finger, just one little pinky, to invite the people in Congress, Democrats and Republicans, after eight times trying to pass these extenders for wind and solar, might invite them to Camp David for a weekend and say, guys, gals, can't we work this out? Have you heard the president slamming the table for that? No, it's drill, baby, drill. It's crazy.
So you said the oil companies are standing in the way. Like, who else? Why isn't a bill like that getting passed?
Basically, it's two things, frankly. It's oil companies, and you also have the Republicans in the Senate who have not wanted this bill to be passed. If you ask the people in the solar industry, okay, they haven't wanted it to be passed because they don't want the Democrats to get a victory in this election year. And so you have some really interesting things going on here. Our premier solar company, First Solar is in Toledo, Ohio, okay, and their own senator, Voinovich, voted against extending solar tax credits. So what did First Solar do? And that's why I'm watching this whole campaign and all this stuff in Ohio and everyone denouncing NAFTA. Well, everyone was out there denouncing NAFTA, you know, and talking about poor working class jobs being lost in Ohio. First Solar was opening its newest factory in Frankfurt Oder, East Germany, because the East Germans were providing the tax credits and the market for a solar industry. And so 300 great engineering jobs moved from Ohio to Frankfurt Oder, East Germany, and their own senator, Voinovich, voted against them. Sununu from New Hampshire voted against to defeat the solar energy tax credits when the best solar equipment company in the world, maybe GT Solar, is in his own state. Now, how many times do you think oil senators vote against oil companies in America? Never. But when it comes to solar or wind, no problem, baby, because the solar and wind, they don't give campaign contributions. You know, they can't twist your arm. They can't fly you on their airplane. They're not big enough yet.
Outside of people who are really committed to a green energy future, I think a lot of people assume when you start talking about a green energy future that it's going to be boring. There's all these kind of like crunchy granola stereotypes about anybody who's interested in a green energy future. What's your approach to kind of shattering that?
Well, that's really what the whole book is about. You know, I mean, see, the problem with the issue green was for all these years, the term green was really owned by its opponents. You know, I'm a big believer, and we may have talked about this before, to name something is to own it. You know, if you can name an issue, you really own the issue. And so the people who basically named green were basically its opponents and critics. And they named it a liberal, tree-hugging, a girly man, sissy, unpatriotic, vaguely French. Vaguely French. And basically what I'm really out to do in this book is to rename green. Geopolitical, geostrategic, geoeconomic, innovative, competitive, patriotic, green is the new red, white, and blue. because this is all of those things. To conservatives, I say, look, this book is a plan to make America stronger, more energy secure, more nationally secure, more competitive, more entrepreneurial, and more economically healthy and more respected in the world. Oh, and by the way, all that stuff Al Gore talks about, we'll take care of that as a byproduct. To liberals and to Greens, I say, I've got a plan to make America greener. Oh, and by the way, all that stuff that Dick Cheney talks about, we'll take care of that as a byproduct. Now, why am I doing this? Is this some cute conceit? No, it's because I honestly believe that this is an issue that joins both of these things, and not only does it intellectually, but it must. Because if you don't do that, if green is just owned as a kind of Birkenstock sandal-wearing, hippie, wine, cheese-eating issue, okay, and isn't seen as an issue about national security and growth and making America stronger, healthier, more competitive, economically really healthy and secure, then we'll never have scale, Terry. And without scale on this issue, you really got nothing.
I know you think our energy future really relies on good leadership, on a government that gets it when it comes to an alternative energy plan and an alternative to our oil addiction. But at the same time, you want to encourage people to do the right thing in their own lives. So what are some of the things that you think are easiest to do to, you know, lead a more greener a more greener life?
I mean, you know, I think, again, that what I really – try to argue in the book for is that we need a clean energy system, because only a system will allow ordinary people to do extraordinary things. That, you know, ordinary people who are struggling with a mortgage to get through their day, okay, they can't think of the 205 easy ways to go green. And therefore, we need a system that, you know, turns off the lights for you, you know, when you leave the room or go down the hall. You know, we need a system that will create all this energy efficiency for you automatically. That's why a system is so important. But what can individuals do? I think there's things you want to do personally and things you want to do politically. You know, personally, the thing you can do, and this is what we try to do in our family, is be a work in progress. You know what I mean? Nobody's perfect, man. I'm sure not. I'll tell you that. I've got plenty of energy hoggery, you know, in my life. But we're trying to be a work in progress. So I can afford to buy a hybrid car. I can afford to install a solar system. I do that. Everyone may find something else. Maybe they'll take the subway once a week. Maybe they'll ride to work when they can. Maybe their kids will, God, walk to school again and not have mom or dad in their SUV, you know, drive them and then sit in the parking lot with the car idling, you know, for 30 minutes waiting for them to get out. And so, you know, Amory Lovins, I once asked him, the great, you know, environmental entrepreneur. I said, Amory, you know, what do you do and how do you be, you know, environmentally energy conscious? And he had a really good answer to it. He just said, pay attention. So that's on the personal level. On the political level, really what you want to hear from a politician is, you know, are you ready to impose a tax on carbon or gasoline and offset it with a reduction in payroll taxes? So we're getting people we're incentivizing them to work more and to consume fewer dirty fuels. Are you ready to do that? Are you ready to support these investment and production tax credits that make it a no-brainer to invest in alternative energy? And are you ready to support what are called, this is a sort of technical gobbledygook, but very important, renewable portfolio standards? And those are the standards that say to your utility in your state, by the year 2025, you have to produce 30% of your energy from renewable power. Why is that important? Because it creates a huge market. So the EU today, the European Union, already has a renewable energy portfolio standard for all of Europe. And that's why all these energy companies are going over their renewable energy companies to try to do business and start companies. What do we have? We have 26 states, I think, that have renewable portfolio standards and another 24 that don't. So we have this completely balkanized market, which doesn't then attract the companies you need. The third thing you need to do, or third or fourth, I don't know where I am on the list, is that we need to change the bargain between you and your utility. For 100 years, our electric companies have gotten rich by getting you to consume more energy. You remember when your mom and dad, when you left the lights on, came into your room and said, excuse me, Terry, but do you own stock in the electric company?
They said that.
There was a reason they said that, because when you left the lights on, the electric company stock went up. We need to change that bargain. This is already begun in California and in Idaho, where your electric utility gets rich doing the right thing. That is, it gets rich in terms of how much energy it gets its customers to save year over year, rather than how much electricity it gets them to consume. We need to change that bargain for every utility in the country. So those are the things I'd focus on in terms of legislation. And in your personal life, do whatever you can. Because whatever you do, when you buy different light bulbs, when you buy a different car, when you demand different insulation, when you look for energy efficient products, you're creating another little opening and widening of the market for those goods. And that's a really good thing.
The first day of the Republican convention was virtually canceled as a result of Hurricane Gustav. Now, you can't say that any one hurricane is the result of climate change, but I think a lot of people who study these things believe that the pattern of extreme weather is connected to climate change. So as the Republican convention is being affected so profoundly, not to mention the residents of New Orleans and other places along the Gulf Coast, we learn that the vice presidential Republican nominee, Sarah Palin, doesn't believe that climate change is affected by human behavior. So what went through your mind when you heard that?
Well, the northern edge of Alaska is basically melting off into the ocean, and she doesn't believe that mankind has anything to do with climate change. I would just have to ask her a very simple question. Have you studied this issue? Have you read the literature? Have you talked to climatologists in your own state about it? Or is this simply a political mantra, that you've gotten because it's convenient and fits with your expedient political needs at the moment? I mean, on what basis are you making that claim? We have before us the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate, the world's top 2,500 climatologists who have concluded that mankind is, in fact, interfering with the climate. Do you have science to the contrary? The point, Terry, is that, this is not global warming. The chapter, as you know, in the book I have on climate is called global weirding, which is a term coined by Hunter Lovins. And because I think that's a much better description of what's going to go on. The weather's going to get weird. It isn't just going to get warm. What happens with climate change is you get more extremes. You get hotter hots, longer droughts, wetter wets, more frequent and forceful hurricanes, tornadoes showing up in cities where they've never showed up. That's what's going to happen. To think it's all this gentle little global warming, that's not what's going to go on. The weather is going to get weird. And in case you haven't noticed, the weather's getting weird. And, to me, the really unnerving kind of thing about this moment, and I relate this discussion I have in the book with Nate Lewis, who's an energy chemist at Caltech, is I came to Nate one day, he was really one of my tutors. I said, Nate, what is it about Katrina that kind of bothered us so much? And he rolled that around, that idea around in his head for a minute. And he said, who made it hot? And I said, what? And he said, what's going on now is we've introduced so much CO2 into Mother Nature's operating system, we don't know anymore the difference between an act of God and an act of man. Who made it hot? We don't know anymore.
Tom Friedman, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Tom Friedman is a columnist for the New York Times. His new book is called Hot, Flat, and Crowded. Coming up, J.J. Abrams, the co-creator of Alias and Lost, discusses his new series, Fringe, about investigations into the secret world of fringe science. This is Fresh Air. J.J. Abrams is a writer and producer of TV shows and films that tend to be filled with lots of action and even more twists and turns. His first TV series, Felicity, didn't fall into that category, but Lost sure did. So did Alias, Mission Impossible 3, and Cloverfield. Next year, Abrams' new Star Trek movie will be released, with the hope it will reboot that franchise the way Dark Knight rebooted Batman. And tomorrow night on Fox, Abrams presents his latest TV series, Fringe. Before we hear the interview he recorded with our TV critic, David Bianculli, let's hear a scene from Fringe. Fringe is about an FBI agent named Olivia Dunham, played by Anna Torv, who teams up with a father-son team to investigate unusual phenomena. The father, played by John Noble, a somewhat mad scientist, has been locked in a mental institution. The estranged son, played by Joshua Jackson, believed his father was working on more mundane things like toothpaste, until Olivia explained what was really going on. Well, she sort of explained it.
He worked out of Harvard, but not on toothpaste. He was part of a classified U.S. Army experimental program called Kelvin Genetics. They gave him the resources to do whatever work he wanted, which was primarily in an area called fringe science.
When you say fringe science, you mean pseudoscience?
I suppose. Things like mind control, teleportation, astral projection, invisibility, genetic mutation, reanimation.
Well, excuse me for a sec. Reanimation, really? So you're telling me what? My father was Dr. Frankenstein.
That was Anna Torv and Joshua Jackson in a scene from the pilot of Fringe. J.J. Abrams, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, J.J., why don't you start by explaining that explanation? What's going on in your show?
Fringe takes place in this sort of weird gray area where what we know to be true and what we know to be possible is sort of pushed just far enough that it's preposterous. And at the same time, every day, you know, you read in the paper online, you read about insane medical and scientific events that are occurring or breakthroughs that are made. And so we wanted to make sure that it's clear in the show that these are the kind of things, it's the sort of world that we will be playing with.
It seems like the pilot draws a little bit on the X-Files and a little bit on Altered States and maybe even on some weird things that you wouldn't want to take credit for, like The Cell. What's the tone you're trying to set, and how much emphasis are you placing on the show's look and its sound?
I think that, first of all, the show, without question, was inspired by a whole slew of things. I was a huge fan of David Cronenberg films when I was a kid. I loved Altered States. The Twilight Zone was my favorite show of all time. And certainly the idea of doing a series that is, on the one hand, a procedural, that is some mystery or crime that is solved every week, mixed with some kind of odd science fiction or genre, leads you, without question, to the X-Files. So the influences were enormous, and all those shows, you know, The Night Stalker and those movies relied heavily on the look and the sound. Even the Cronenberg films, you know, the early ones may not have been as obviously stylized as something, you know, like The Cell, for example. The fact is that the visuals were the things that really landed often. You know, Scanners, the guy's head exploding, and, you know, the things that he would do that were so insane, Videodrome, having, you know, characters reaching into their bodies and pulling out, you know, VHS tapes. It was ridiculous. So to me, the what you see and what you hear, I mean, it's a visual medium and an oral medium. So I think that, you know, obviously we're trying to use that stuff as well as possible.
The first time you directed, I think, on television was an episode of Felicity. And that's not that long ago. Is that correct?
Yes, it was two episodes of Felicity, yeah.
So you just jump ahead not too many years, and instead of directing Kerry Russell, whom you helped make a star, you're directing Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible 3.
With Kerry Russell.
With Kerry Russell, yes. So what's the difference between becoming a director on a giant, giant movie set like that with such an established movie star and still doing the sort of directing that you want to do?
With Mission Impossible, it was an incredible thing. From the very beginning, Tom said to me, this is going to be your movie. And I was warned by a lot of people, smart, experienced people, you know, who said, listen, you got to be careful. I know so-and-so who worked with, you know, this other guy over here, and that was a nightmare, and this is an actor, producer, and that was, and I was like, it's not going to happen this time. I can just tell. And I have to say, there was not a day on the set of that movie where he didn't stand by his word. And so the answer to your question, honestly, is when we did Felicity, and it was the first series that I was involved with, the actors were completely game and were wonderful and worked with Matt Reeves and myself to make the thing as good as it could be. And I found myself on the set of this big Hollywood blockbuster with my name on the director chair, and I was surrounded by actors, including, you know, one of the biggest in the world, who was doing nothing but trying to realize that vision I had. And I have to tell you, it is as surreal as the moment was when he asked me if I wanted to do it. The entire experience of directing the movie was equally surreal because it was the dream version of what you'd want. And I am beholden to him for that chance.
There's a dramatic technique you use at the beginning of that movie that you like a lot. I certainly like it a lot watching it as a viewer, which is throwing you into some point of the action at the very start and then doing flashbacks to get you back up to speed. I mean, Lost is virtually based on it. You did it in some episodes in Alias. And here it is starting this huge movie. Why? What about that appeals to you?
I guess I like the puzzle nature of it. I love throwing an audience into a situation that you have to scramble to figure out. And then just as you're watching something that is a cliffhanger, you pull out of the scene and go to 48 hours earlier. And you're suddenly engaged in the minutia of a moment in a way that you wouldn't be otherwise, because it's been informed with some sort of, you know, climactic moment yet to come. And there's something that is inherently fascinating to me about watching something with the awareness of where it goes. I mean, it's sort of, you know, when you watch, you know, news clips from the past and you're aware of the fate of that particular person, or mm-hmm. you know, you know, how it ended for that couple, or you know, whatever the situation. And there's something that sort of stirs emotions for me. And so it's not, look, I mean, ultimately what it is a gimmick, and we all, you know, have our gimmicks and things that we like to do, and you got to be careful. You can't do that kind of stuff too often. And I think, you know, I probably do, and it's one of those things that I, you know.
I enjoy it. I'll stick by you.
God bless you, first of all. And secondly, you know, at a certain point, you know, there are certain things that I guess begin to define the kind of work that someone does. And so maybe that's one of my, you know, stupid tricks. But the thing that I like about it is that you get to sort of have little mundane moments have real meaning. And you also start, as the audience member, you're figuring out how you get there at the same time as you're trying to figure out, well, how the hell is he or she going to get out of that one? So I like that it kind of engages your brain on a couple levels. And when it works, I think it can be a really effective device.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with writer, director, producer J.J. Abrams. You seem very, very interested in plot and the intricacies of plots and puzzles and things like that. Who were some of the authors that you enjoyed growing up? Who influenced you?
Well, I have to say that the thing that was the most impactful to me was it was more television than literature. And Rod Serling is the one author I can really point to. I mean, it's funny with Fringe, which was very much inspired by the movie Altered States, the sort of world of it, which was written by Paddy Chayefsky, who was a contemporary
of Rod Serling's.
And there's something about the use of heartbreaking character in incredibly unusual and often scary situations that just, you know, gets me every time. And you can look at, you know, so many episodes, because most, you know, have some incredible thing in them, and many of them are just masterpieces. But you look at The Twilight Zone and you see how often he was able to, whether he wrote them or produced them, take characters who were broken or deeply troubled, and he'd put them in situations that were so strange and so frightening. And there were two things going on. One thing was, you know, you thought what you were getting was the impact of, you know, the genre, the kind of science fiction or the sort of the twist of it. But the thing that you were really investing in was the heart of these people. So that to me was really inspiring. The other thing he was doing was he was writing about things that actually mattered to him. Mr. Serling had gotten into incredible trouble with the censors and with networks and advertisers, writing about things that really mattered, socially conscious issues, you know, race, politics. And when he did The Twilight Zone, you know, the decision he made to essentially make it about aliens instead of African Americans, you know what I mean, to take the thing that was important to him and hide it in genre allowed him to continue to write, but in allegory, about things that really were critically important. And so I think that the thing that The Twilight Zone did was connect these dramatic sort of heart-wrenching characters with situations that were just creepy. And I think that either element without the other would never have been as impactful. But together, it was this kind of perfect kind of peanut butter cup thing where you had your chocolate, you had your peanut butter, but together it was just undeniable.
J.J. Abrams, thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Dave.
J.J. Abrams speaking with our TV critic David Bianculli. Abrams' new TV series Fringe premieres tomorrow night on Fox. David Bianculli writes about television for Broadcasting and Cable Magazine and TVWorthWatching.com. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross, and we're happy to welcome John Sheehan to our staff. You've probably heard his name before in our credits because he's often worked with us as a freelancer. It will be a pleasure to have him with us full.